Hey, it's Jen Hatmaker. Here's what I've learned in midlife. Joy isn't the reward you earn after all the work is done. Joy is the work. That's what this new series on For the Love is all about. The sacred, yes. It's choosing delight, rest, and pleasure on purpose. Because saying yes to yourself, that's the thing that finally lets you fill your table with everybody else. Come find your sacred yes with me. Follow and listen to For the Love wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio, 103.1 FM, 910, 980 AM, or anywhere on that free Odyssey app. You know, you can play us on your smart speakers, too. You just tell them, those little suckers, WILK, play WILK News Radio. I'm not going to say their name because I'll start getting the complaints. But you know who they are, those smart speakers some of us have in our house. You just tell it to play it, and it'll play it live. You got the app. You can go back, the rewind feature. Some great stuff. And you can get us anywhere you get your favorite podcast. Just search The Rob O'Donnell Show. It's 4:11, 74 degrees here on this Wednesday, April 23rd, 2025. Tomorrow, I'll be here tomorrow, but I'm going to be skipping out a little early tomorrow, probably about 4:30. I'm emceeing the Lackawanna County GOP 2025 Spring Dinner, where they're honoring Ernie Priett. Looks like a great list of guests there showing up at the Glenmora National Golf Club. I don't know. They say it's pretty well going to be pretty well attended. It's going to be tomorrow. I believe the doors open at 5 or 5:30. I'm not sure exactly. I think 5:30. But tomorrow, April 24th, and you can go to LackawannaGOP.org to see if there's any tickets available if you're looking to go and get up there. It's going to be a good time. It's going to be a good event. Good time, so hopefully I see a lot of you there. I know a lot of listeners say they're going to be up there. I know some groups are going to have tables up there, so it's going to be a good time. But I'll be skipping out of here about 4:30, so we'll be replaying stuff from the earlier hour and a half, and maybe some segments for today for that last hour and a half. So I apologize for that, but there's no way I can get up there and get set up and do what I need to do. You know, that's where we're at there. So this next story, you know, I found this just looking through the plethora of media that I go through every morning, the plethora of stuff. And I found this extremely interesting for a couple of reasons. A, because of what it's about, and it's, you know, it's sort of my family's wheelhouse when it comes to the military. But, you know, I ended up sharing this with a couple of high-ranking retired members of the Navy who also said this is just incredible. A Ford automobile was unexpectedly found in the hangar of the USS Yorktown aircraft carrier shipwreck that sank during World War II. I love these kind of stories. I love these kind of specials on TV and such. Hopefully, I hope they're doing something with this because it looks like it definitely has the potential for it. A crew exploring the USS Yorktown shipwreck made an unexpected discovery when they located a mysterious Ford automobile among the wreckage over the weekend, officials said. The faint outline of a suspected 1940 or 41 Black Ford Super Deluxe Woody was found Saturday by a remote-operated vehicle in the hangar deck of the historic World War II aircraft carrier that sank during the Battle of Midway in 1942, according to the NOAA Ocean Exploration. I really hope they're doing a special on this. And Body Shop Guy, if you're listening, how would you like to get your hands on a 1940 or 41 Black Ford Super Deluxe Woody? Further exploration the following day showed the car upright with part of its license plate reading Ship Service, U.S. Navy. And the windshield still intact about 3 miles below the surface. Is that a car? Is that really a car? A researcher was heard saying on the live stream of the expedition. That's a full car, the explorer said. Why is there a car on the boat? Another researcher asked. NOAA officials believe, and I did get the answer to this, although they kind of insinuate it in a story here. NOAA officials believe the car might have been used by Rear Admiral Jack Fletcher or Captain Elliot Buckmaster, or other senior crew members while the Yorktown was docked at foreign ports. That's exactly what it was used for. The researchers question why the vehicle was left on the vessel as the crews desperately hurled heavy machinery off the sinking ship to lessen its load after it was struck by a Japanese torpedo. Yorktown's salvage crew worked tirelessly to jettison anti-aircraft guns and aircraft to reduce the list after the torpedo strike, but did leave the car, something they could roll off easily on its side, no official said in an email to reporters. Perhaps the car belonged to someone important on the ship or the fleet, the captain or an admiral. There are also questions of why the car remained on the ship after it briefly stopped it off at Pearl Harbor for a 48-hour repair ahead of the planned battle. If you recall, the Yorktown was damaged badly, came into port for repairs, was miraculously repaired and sent back out with the automobile back on it. So that's what they're talking about. You know, why wasn't it? You know, you were just severely damaged. You're getting emergency repairs and you're headed back out for battle. You know, is this really necessary? It was probably tucked away somewhere in the hangar deck and wasn't even contemplated, to be honest with you, speaking to some officials. The USS Yorktown was commissioned in 1937 and took part in several World War II missions in the Pacific before it went down following the attack by the Japanese. The massive shipwreck was discovered upright and intact in May of 1988 in a joint effort by the U.S. Navy and the National Geographic Society. There is a live stream of this. I'm going to check it out probably this weekend if I can get a hold of it, because there is video. It's part of the story, but I'd like to see more of this. It's interesting, but we all know, especially anyone who served in law enforcement, the military and such, here you are, your ship's been hit by a torpedo. And you know, a modern-day aircraft carrier has 5,000 sailors. I would imagine the USS Yorktown had quite less than that, but still, you know, over 1,000. Still in the thousands. You're a young sailor or Marine assigned to the boat. It is severely incapacitated. You were hit by a torpedo. You got all battle stations. And you're jettisoning anti-aircraft guns. You're throwing airplanes off. And some poor guy came across the admiral's car and said, I'm not throwing that overboard. Nope, not me. Nope, not you either. So you know that was the conversation. They, no, you do it. It was like, Mikey, you do it. Nope, no, you do it. I'm not being the one. If we survive this, I'm not going to be the one who pushed the admiral's car overboard. It just goes to show you how disciplined they were and how they looked up to their commanders and admirals back in World War II, and hopefully still do. So I thought that was a great story. There are pictures of this Woody, and it is, I mean, the hood's rusted away, the windshield is completely intact, the side vent windows are there. It appears to be a convertible of some type. Yeah, some really good pictures of it. It's amazing it's still there and still preserved. So great story there. Let me go to the phone now. We have Jim from Wilkes-Barre. Jim.
Hey, Rob.
How are you, my friend?
As usual, tired, cranky, needing a nap. but there's a story up in the Tennessee Star that you might find interesting. It seems that the Democrats' favorite illegal, the guy currently residing in El Salvador, was arrested. You remember when he got arrested in Tennessee with those other folks in the car with him?
If it talks about who owned the car and what their status was, I talked about that earlier in the show.
Oh, you did? I was probably on the road at that point.
I did. The guy he identified as his boss and who's owned the vehicle with the eight immigrants that they were transporting has a record of human smuggling.
He was convicted for it. He did 18 months in prison, then he was deported, and then his employee took up the business for him.
Yep.
Apparently.
Yeah, I did talk about that earlier. I saw it coming across the wires. Listen, this is the, you know, first of all, he was the innocent dad from Maryland, and then they found out that he was a gang member, and it was, well, you can't prove he's a gang member. Well, yeah, we kind of can prove he was a gang member. And then, you know, he's a father and husband. Even if he is a gang member, he's still a human being. Well, then we find out he's a domestic abuser, and, you know, his wife hand wrote a PFA out on him saying how he abused her and her child and their child. And now this. So it's just sooner or later. And I read stories from earlier today, and I'll read them again since you weren't listening. There's probably a lot of other people that were just getting in, tuning in now. Here we go. So yesterday, Politico. Yesterday's Politico headline was, Dems see a winning issue in the case of a man mistakenly deported in El Salvador. Now, that's a Politico headline from yesterday. Less than 24 hours today, the same picture used in the article, The Hill, writes, Democrats wonder if Kilmar Abrego-Garcia's case is a political fight worth having. So they're starting to lose their stomach for this.
Well, it's at this point, it's becoming the death of a thousand cuts.
Yeah, and we've seen them morph. Well, this isn't about him. It's not about he's a gang member. It's not about, you know, if he was good or bad. This is about due process. And then we find out that he had two hearings in due process, was found to have been said to be removable, just not to El Salvador. And because those situations don't exist anymore and with the rival gang, he was sent to El Salvador. So he did have due process.
Well, and I saw a story somewhere that said that over the course of this gentleman's stay here in the United States, he's been in front of 17 different judges. So he's had due process.
I don't know about 17. I know there were two different ones. They said he could have self-deported at any time and chose to live under the radar, and now he's caught and deported.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, he's been at least detained and arrested and stopped for other things, like that detention in Tennessee.
Yeah, where he just got a ticket for driving without an American license. Yep.
I'm sure there was a judge involved there. Those hearings, you know, for the PFA. If there was a hearing on that, he went in front of a judge.
There actually were multiple hearings because I had all the paperwork on that. There were at least three that I saw.
So he went in front of a judge there, too. They said, you know, it could have cost as much as $5 million with as many hearings as this guy's had. In front of all these different courts, 17 different judges. He's had due process.
Well, like I said yesterday before I got to go up, I said this yesterday. Let me ask an honest question. I asked this to the public as to motive. How many of us knew who Senator Van Hollen was before this?
Who?
Exactly. Exactly. So that's the motive behind this. He wanted a national name recognition. These other four are jumping on it now. A little too late because now they're taking the most flack because all this other information's coming out. But it's, hey, let them keep going. Keep pushing the 80-20 topics. We'll love it. Just like I said, AOC, Democrats should demand that she get a leadership position since she's polling so high.
Well, you know what? I think all those Democrats that went down there, they were just going down to get their gang tats and gang nicknames. You know, like Von Hollen. Maybe his nickname could be Fluffy or something.
All right, Jim. Thanks for checking in. I'm up against traffic and weather.
All right, Rob. See you.
Thank you. It's 4:23 here at WILK. Time for 2020 traffic and weather. Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio. 4:28, 74 degrees on this Wednesday, April 23rd. So we have this raging wildfire in New Jersey, just to our east. So far, I'm looking at 13,000 acres in New Jersey. It's only about 30% contained. Firefighters were battling the Jones Road wildfire, which is burning over about 13 square miles. 13 square miles. Through the night and broke out at 11 a.m. on Lacey and Ocean Townships in Ocean County. Utilizing fire engines, bulldozers, air support, ground crews, according to the New Jersey Fire Service. This is an all hands on deck. I know they even have the National Guard involved now. As of last night, it was only 10% contained, but I heard today it's 30%. So they are gaining some ground, but this dry weather, winds, it looks like we're not going to get really any kind of rain until Friday evening into Saturday. So that doesn't help here much. I did get reports locally of some sporadic small brush fires here in our area. Listen, this time of year is the time, and I don't care what the status is. I did see some counties put out a total burn ban. I know there's been burn bans in and out of active status. There's no – lean on the safe side here. Truly lean on the safe side that the way these fires travel – They can even travel through underground dried root systems. So if you do not see the fire on the top, if there's not dry grass on top, it does not mean that it could spread. I'm looking now that they're saying it's 12,000 acres and 35% contained. Thankfully, I have not heard of any structures or businesses or anything damaged. It's been strictly forested areas, which is a good thing. But it was right on the cusp of some neighborhoods, looking at some of the pictures that friends were sending me and friends of mine who were in the police and fire service. So just be aware for the next few weeks till things really green up and we start getting out, especially now this time of year as you're getting your...
Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of The Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to The Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
One of my neighbors cut their grass, and it always gets to me when someone cuts their grass this early. And I understand you have to. Up by me, you really don't, but I understand down in the valley in the warmer areas, it's grass cutting time. But when you take your lawnmower or your ride on or your zero turn or your push out for the first time, you know, just be aware you're starting up as you're putting gas in it, as you're doing what you do with it, those backfires, something, sparks could set some dry brush on fire. So just be aware when you're taking your lawn equipment out for the first time, just be cautious. It's been sitting for a while. You know, those backfires do sometimes get some sparks and some flames and some debris out of it that could set this off. But just be careful for the next few weeks until we're out of the harm zone, because we don't need something like this here. You think about 13 square miles somewhere here. That could be very bad very quickly. So prayers to them out there fighting this and dealing with it. They're doing a great job. I believe parts of the New Jersey Turnpike were even closed yesterday. About 25,000 homes and businesses are without power because Central Jersey Power and Light cut electricity to aid firefighters, and if anything catches fire, to prevent further damages. So we'll be monitoring this situation. Hopefully, before the end of the week, this is more under control. Like I said, 10% last night, 35% now from what I just saw on TV. So that's a good thing. They're making good progress. Slow but steady. It's 4:32 here at WILK. It's time for the news with our friend Paul Michaels. Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio. It's the point of the show where we honor our heroes here at home who made the ultimate sacrifice in law enforcement. On this day 5, Pennsylvania professionals made the ultimate sacrifice. We're going to start off with police officer Robert Patrick Smith, Philadelphia Police Department in 1980. Died of a heart attack after a 2-block foot chase to help capture a man with a knife who had been threatening parents outside of a parochial school at 18th and Stillis Streets. Officer Smith was a 20-year veteran. Sergeant Samuel Harrison Hewitt, Philadelphia Police Department in 1947, as well as Officer James Quigley, were shot and killed following a pursuit of a stolen vehicle. When the vehicle they were pursuing crashed at the intersection of Stenton Avenue and Sedgwick Street, the suspect fled on foot, then opened fire on the officers as they pursued him, killing Sergeant Hewitt and Officer Quigley. The suspect was convicted of both murders and sentenced to life in prison. He was released in prison in 1972 and 2 years later murdered his foster mother. He was sentenced to life in prison for that murder as well. I guess life in prison doesn't mean what it used to. Even back then, 1947. Private John E. Fessler, Pennsylvania State Police, in 1937, was shot and killed while assisting Montour County deputies arrest of a drunken man who had been terrorizing his family. As they approached the home, the man opened fire, wounding Private Fessler. The deputies returned fire, wounding the suspect. Private Fessler succumbed to his wounds the following day. The 51-year-old suspect was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to death on February 23, 1940, the day before he was executed. He shot and killed himself in Monroe County Jail. The sheriff said 8 members of his family had visited him earlier and suspected that one of them slipped him a .32 caliber pistol. Well, at least he decided to take himself out, not anyone else. Good riddance. Patrolman Edward Frederick Stever, Eakland Borough Police Department in 1922, was shot and killed near the intersection of Buffalo Street and Main Street while attempting to question a suspicious person at approximately 1:30 a.m. He had followed the man for several blocks. When he asked the man to stop, the subject suddenly turned and shot him twice in the chest. Patrolman Stever was taken to a local doctor where he succumbed to his wounds several hours later. The subject fled the scene and was never apprehended. Patrolman Stever had only served with the Eakland Borough Police Department for 3 weeks, survived by his wife and two young children. And those are our five from here in Pennsylvania. Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio. It's time for Today in History, Scranton edition, because how do we know where we're going unless we remember where we've been? I was able to get this information by the use of several consultants and at least three grants, so we'll see how it turns out here. But today is today's Scranton's birthday. We're going to talk about how and why. Scranton, Pennsylvania has a rich history tied to its industrial growth and strategic location in Lackawanna Valley. Here's an overview on its founding and incorporation. The pre-settlement in the area would become Scranton, as originally inhabited by the Lenape and other Native American tribes. European settlers began arriving in the late 18th century. Early 19th century, the region, initially called Slocum Hollow, saw a modest settlement due to its proximity to the Lackawanna River and natural resources like coal and iron. The land was part of Luzerne County, and before Lackawanna County was established in 1878. The iron industry founded the Scranton. It's closely linked to the iron industry. In 1840, brothers Selden and George Scranton, along with their cousin Joseph Scranton and other investors, established an iron forge in the Slocum Hollow to capitalize on the area's anthracite, coal, and iron ore deposits. They formed the Lackawanna Iron and Coal Company, which became the economic backbone of the area. By the mid-1840s, the growing settlement was renamed Scranton in honor of the Scranton family, who were instrumental in industrial development for the area. Its first incorporation, a borough status, in 1856. February 14, 1856, Scranton was officially incorporated as a borough, reflecting its growing population and economic significance. This status allowed for local governance and infrastructure development. As the iron industry boomed and the population swelled, Scranton was incorporated as a city on April 23, 1866. Today, this milestone solidified the status as a major industrial hub, driven by iron production, coal mining, and later railroads. Scranton's location in the heart of anthracite coal region fueled its industrial rise, earning the nickname the Anthracite Capital of the World. The arrival of the Delaware, Lackawanna, and Western Railroad in the 1850s connected Scranton to broader markets, boosting its economy. Waves of immigrants, particularly from Ireland, Wales, and Eastern Europe, settled in Scranton to work in the mines, mills, and factories, shaping its cultural and demography identity. By the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Scranton was a thriving industrial city, with a peak population of over 140,000 in 1930. Became known for its innovation like the electric streetcar, earning it the nickname the Electric City. Was a major center for coal mining until the industry's decline after World War II. The city faced economic challenges in the mid-20th century as coal mining waned, but has since diversified its economy, focusing on education, healthcare, and tourism, while preserving its historical legacy. Scranton's founding and incorporation were driven by the vision of industrials like the Scranton brothers and the region's abundant natural resources, which transformed a small settlement into a key American city. I'm glad I found it. I know a lot of you are glad you found it. A lot of you are multi-generational here. My parents moved here, a few years before I did, down in just outside of Scranton, down in Madisonville Township, still Lackawanna County. And believe it or not, I I circled a bubble on where the New Yorkers didn't go. And I bought my house just outside of that bubble because dealing with the Poconos for too many years, I didn't want to live and leaving New York. You know, I wanted to get away from that and assimilate to here. And I think I did a good job of doing that. Isolated myself up in the rural mountains of northern Lackawanna County, right on the Susquehanna border. But it's a good place. Good place to be. Hopefully, hopefully with the right leadership, it maintains that way. And it could. We'll see. DL&W, my grandfather retired from that and was our family built for it, from it. Text messages coming in. Looking at some other text messages happening here. And it you know, looking at the refurbishment that we see, you know, I was talking a little about it in jest, talking about how it was, you know, such a task to light up the tower for St. Patrick's Day. But in all honesty, I mean, there it is truly a gem of this area. It's unfortunate that it's not more accessible. That was one of the topics during the debate of making City Hall more accessible. And I understand the arguments. I don't agree with the arguments. Basically, they're one of the mayor's standing points is safety and security. And well, that's any City Hall has a safety and security issue. Now, there should be places that the public can go, and there should be places that the public don't go. Obviously, the public shouldn't be walking into, you know, offices in the area, but there should be a reception area. There should be places to where you can go talk to people, and somebody can come out and talk to you. There should obviously be a mix of secured and open spaces like most other city halls. A lot of places have security checkpoints. Now, I would imagine the argument's going to be, well, if you want to put a police officer, which is the standard for a lot of cities like Scranton size and above, their answer will be, well, do you want to take a police officer off the street to post them at City Hall? No, I want you to hire an additional police officer and put them there. And this way, if something happens at or around City Hall, they're there to respond. But their primary duty would be to City Hall, like most other city halls of this size and bigger. But that's what the argument would be. You know, where do you want to take a police officer away from to put one here? It's not this or that. It's not and or. They also point to that there's state law that says a municipality cannot prevent someone with a firearm from coming into a municipal building. That is true. That is state law. And it supersedes municipal law. So you're telling me that every legal gun owner in Pennsylvania, in Scranton, in this area, is a threat to the city of government? Is that what they're saying? Because that person who legally carries a firearm anywhere else is just as much anywhere outside of City Hall, if you're a potential threat, than inside City Hall, correct? So it's interesting that someone who is legally practicing their constitutional right, has gotten their concealed carry permit, and as a law-abiding citizen is seen as a potential threat in City Hall, when the law specifically says that, the state law specifically says that a municipality cannot prevent a legally possessed firearm owner from entering a municipal building. So their answer is, we just don't let anybody in. See, the argument falls apart when you start questioning it. And the answer is not less access. The answer is not no access. The answer should be, how do we provide access safely? Well, you obviously have places in City Hall that people can and can't go. You obviously have a reception area where you can actually talk to people who can get the proper person out to maybe answer questions or maybe talk to you. And if they're not busy, schedule an appointment for when you can come back and they're available. It's not hard if you have the will to do it. It's not hard if you're open to doing these things. So I find a lot of the arguments when it comes to that is non-starters. And there should be follow-up there. Do you see every legal, lawfully possessed firearm owner in the city of Scranton as a threat? Because if you do, you have a greater problem as someone who's not only the executive for the city of Scranton, but who swears to uphold the Constitution, the laws of the city, state, and government. Just a thought. It's 4:55 here at WILK. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio. You've seen former First Lady Michelle Obama is doing this podcast with her brother. And I guess it's her way to speak out. And it's been controversial on a lot of topics, especially in sparking the rumors that her and former President Barack Obama might be in some relationship trouble. It all stemmed from this podcast. Well, she was on this podcast recently, and she's made a statement. It says that black women haven't been given permission to articulate their pain. Michelle Obama says black women haven't been given permission to articulate their pain. Let me get this straight now. So you were the first lady of the United States of America, and you're going to get on a podcast and play victim. You own multiple mansions. You are no doubt a millionaire. This country has treated you extremely well, and you're going to play the victim. I just don't get it. Don't get it. But at least MSNBC's host Jen Psaki, you know, Miss Red Hair, she said that there's obviously a rooted value in the kind MSC viewers expect when we talk about the opposition. She says that her network is slanted towards the president, and that's just the way the audience likes it. It's 5 o'clock. We'll be back.
Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense, while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.